All right, we're going to get started. Welcome, everybody. I'm Jeff. Lane's is my wife's and my restaurant. We're Alexandrian cuisine, and a lot of the dishes you're trying are based on my wife's family recipes from Alexandria, Egypt, the original Alexandria. So we appreciate you coming here, and I'd like to see you eating and drinking is keeping us in business. We've turned this into a literary salon. I've interviewed well over 100 authors at this point. Not sure of the exact number, but I've been looking forward to this one. Bill and I have been on a bunch of panels, at least a couple in recent years, so intelligence panels and things, so it should be a lot of fun. If you're a writer or if you know a writer, we offer free space, and we like to make this a safe space where people can come in and just celebrate their work. We partner with Mystery Writers of America and International Thriller Writers and a bunch of different groups. So we have authors from all over the place. We do short stories, children's books, whatever it is. So if somebody wants to do something with one of their books, please refer them to me. And we'll love to bring them in, because honestly, in the restaurant business is brutal, but talking to authors is one of my favorite things. So I'm really enjoying it. So Bill Rapp received a BA from Notre Dame, an MA from the University of Toronto, and a PhD from Vanderbilt. He began his professional life as an academic, teaching European history at Iowa State University. He spent the last 43 years as an analyst, diplomat, and senior executive at the Central Intelligence Agency, both as a staff employee for 35 years, and then another 7, and still counting, as a part-time consultant and trainer after his retirement in 2017. That doesn't make a retirement, really, when you're still working full-time. His career has taken him around the world, including to Berlin as the wall fell. And shout out for the wall falling. Fantastic. To Germany when it was reunified. Bill's currently writing an espionage series that follows the adventures of fictional CIA officer Carl Baer as he confronts the challenges facing the United States and the CIA during the Cold War. The Simon and Sagan, which places Baer in Vietnam in 1964, is the 6th book in this series. Bill draws on his extensive background and experiences as an intelligence officer and his previous career as a historian in modern Europe to craft authentic and historic thrillers that inform and entertain readers, while not giving too much away about the world he worked in for the last 4 decades. Bill is proudly a member of the Mystery Writers of America, International Thriller Writers, and the International Association of Crime Writers. So please welcome Bill Rapp. Bill, it's a pleasure to have you. We're videotaping this for a future podcast or to put it up on YouTube or do something with it. But it's a good way to get the word out about your fantastic books.
Thanks very much. And thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. Hopefully you'll enjoy yourself this evening.
Yeah, coming out and supporting authors is really a big thing, because it's solitary work, and it's hard to make a buck doing it too. So it's nice when you get friends and family and colleagues and readers to come out and show you some love, right?
Yeah, I can testify to the difficulty of making a buck on this line of work. But that's, as a lot of you probably suspect, that's not why you do this. I mean, I knew I was never going to get rich. Obviously, if you're going to make a bestseller list, that's wonderful. But you can't write with that in mind. You write because of the story that's inside you and drawing on your own experiences. And it's really rewarding. One of the great rewards is when you realize there are people out there who have read your book, like your stuff, and give you the feedback and show up for occasions like this.
And Bill and I were just in the Suffolk Book Festival yesterday and had lots of readers coming up. And that's fun. How much do you enjoy talking to readers? Or is it weird when they're coming to you talking to you about your characters and something that's been in your head all that time before that?
I wouldn't say it's weird, actually. It's very enjoyable. I kind of enjoy engaging with people more than doing social media. Part of that's probably generational, because it takes me a while. I always have to get my daughters and my wife to help me, you know, push the right button on the computer and whatnot, you know. So I really, really enjoy that. And almost everybody that comes up to your table has their own story to tell, and their own, as why they're interested in this, why they're thinking about buying your book, or if they've read it, what they like about it. And it's one of the great rewards of engaging in that. Of course, you want them to buy the book too while they're talking to you there. And most do. But even others don't. They're very interested in the project, and they might say, well, I'm going to take one of your bookmarks or a card. I'm going to do some research on the series. And if you're confident at all in what you're doing and the project that you've got and the mission of your writing, you're pretty confident that some of those people are going to engage and actually, you know, buy the book or get the Kindle version or something like that. And you're hoping that if they buy just the one book, they'll be engaged enough that they'll come back to get more afterwards. And that often happens. I think one incident I remember at the Northern Virginia Christmas market, a woman had come up and she had bought one book one year for her son. She says, he's interested in this kind of stuff. She came back the next year and she says, my son loved your book. I want the rest of the series. You know, that's the kind of reward that really makes you feel good about what you're doing.
That's the beauty of the series, too,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, I often ask readers when they come up, you know, what is it you like to read? And do you use any of that feedback you get from people, or does it make you think about future projects if you're talking to 50 or 60 readers in a given day at a conference?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, since they're your potential customers or customers already, you want to respond to that. So you kind of get a gauge if there's things that say that, well, you know, I wasn't too sure about this character. I could have used a little more development on this character. Maybe keep that in mind. I find as you're working through it, you think, okay, I'll do a little more here. I'll give this person a little more background, you know, to make him or her more real. There was one woman who showed up at, the exception is one woman showed up at that same Christmas market. She had bought the fifth book in the series, Turkish Triangle. She came back this last year and she says, well, do you have another book on turkey in your series? And I said, no, that's it right now. And she says, well, I'll come back and buy a book when you write another one that takes place in Turkey. I'm not sure that's on the horizon.
I don't think people understand how much work and research goes into these things. Well, we're here to talk about Assignment in Saigon. So why don't you give us a little bit, just a little back jacket copy. What's the book about?
Assignment in Saigon involves Carl Beyer has been working on the seventh floor. Anybody that's affiliated with the agency knows what that means. That's sort of the top floor where all the leadership positions, where most of the leadership positions offices are. And so he's been a special advisor to the director for strategic affairs. It's a job I made up to put him up there. It was a reward because he had a very successful assignment in Turkey in the previous assignment where he went there to investigate the deaths of three Soviet assets during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was able to explain the deaths, but he got pulled into another operation, another mission as well, which I won't go into any kind of detail to make sure you all want to buy the book. So the director says, look, it's 64. Okay, we haven't Americanized the war yet, but we're obviously leaning in that direction. There's a lot of pressure from Johnson, McNamara, Rusk, and others to get us more heavily involved to try and straighten out what's becoming a bigger and bigger mess. He says, I got to go down to these cabinet meetings almost every day. I want you to go out there on a fact-finding mission for me to prepare a report that will better inform me and the other policymakers when I go downtown. And of course, he, a little pushback on this. He says, that's not really my job. We have analysts to do that kind of thing. We have people in the field already. And he says, look, I trust you. I trust your judgment. I want you to do this for me. And he says, and when you go out there, this is your mission. This is your only mission. I don't want you, like typical case officer, getting involved in other operations stuff, you know. Of course, it doesn't work out that way. He goes out there fully intending to fulfill just that mission for the director, but it's inevitable. It's irresistible for him to get pulled in to other things because of the people he meets that he engages with. There's a former OSS officer who was there during the war when Ho Chi Minh declared independence and drew on the American Declaration of Independence as a way to appeal to the United States, who has since, we never really could find his place back in the U.S. afterwards, comes back and he's living in Vietnam. He's also addicted to opium. There's a French officer who was in Dien Bien Phu, escaped, moved to the South and is running a brothel in Saigon. But he's living in obviously a very difficult environment. He wants to make sure he has no enemies. So he wants to help, but he's also working with the French, with the Vietnamese, and perhaps the Chinese or Soviets who are there. There's a Soviet officer who he encounters who knows Beyer from a past experience, Carl Beyer, the hero, and he becomes engaged with him, not in a nice way. So he finds himself struggling against all these other attractions and demands on his time and his expertise. Well, he's still trying to do this thing for the director. And the director, meanwhile, keeps telling him, where's my report? I want you back here. You know, he goes, yeah, I'll be back. And just let me take care of a few things. And in the end, he does do the report. But I'm not going to say any more about that
either. Yeah, no spoilers.
Yeah, no spoilers here.
And so how does that happen with somebody from the seventh floor? Somebody would get somebody's trusted, like, hey, there's a mess over here. I need somebody I trust to go out there. Does that actually happen?
Well, I don't know, because I didn't spend that much time on the seventh floor. You'd have to ask my wife about that. But we did spend a lot of time up there. I think it's very unusual because they do have one. There's the whole analytic cadre that would prepare the analysis of the forecast. And then you have the people in the field. At the time, Vietnam was our largest deployment. And there are vehicles for folks to write reports from the field as well. And that's part of his pushback to the director. You really need me to do this. And he says, yeah, I do. And so if the director wants somebody to do that, as I point out in the book, he's going to do it. And the people in the field are going to do what they can to help, because, you know, you don't say no to the director on something like this.
Some of these international thrillers are complicated. Yeah. Do you remember where the original spark for the idea for this one came from? Is there a moment, or was it just something you putting ideas together over the years?
Well, what happened was, it's as he's marching through the Cold War, he miraculously is assigned to all these crisis situations, you know, that he gets in fumped in the middle of. I thought to myself, well, it's the Cold War. I'm not going to be able to avoid having him do his time in Vietnam. You know, it has to happen. And as I was finishing up the previous book, Turkish Triangle, the publisher said, you've got to lay the seeds for the next story. And so I said, that's where I started to lay the notion that there's going to be some reason why he has to go to Vietnam. I didn't want to put him in a position at his level. He really only would have gone there as a chief of station. I didn't want to put him in that kind of situation. So I thought this would be a special assignment and this would make some sense, but he could still craft a story around that. And I thought, you know, he's probably in Vietnam. It's the same situation I found myself in the 2000s in Iraq. Whatever you thought of policy, you sort of felt, okay, the country, it's got its challenges, it's got its difficulties. I should do what I can to help out. And I think we didn't send anybody to Iraq that didn't volunteer. And so I volunteered. Glad I did. It was, I was there, as I tell people, I was there 386 days, not that I was counting. And it's a difficult on a number of different levels. What I thought, you know, it's for many people felt that you had to go to Iraq to do your part. And I thought it's probably a similar situation or mentality that existed in 64, in the early 60s in Vietnam, because things were obviously sliding downhill. The competitions were arising. The challenges from the U.S. are arising. And people clearly were uncertain how to go about resolving this stuff and getting us out of that mess. So I think, in answer to your question, it was not a long thought out process. It just happened, but I knew at some point all along it was going to happen. It was going to be in Vietnam at some point in this career.
When you mentioned like 386 days, how does that wear on you when you're in like an austere environment or you're in some place, you're just kind of thinking about home. It's the day to day is kind of difficult. Like, yeah. How does that mess with you psychologically?
Well, you know, that was the worst part of it. It wasn't so much the danger or physical threat of it. I mean, it was there. It wasn't as persistent as it was in the few months preceding that, when they called the Iraq had its own March Madness. There was almost daily bombings of the folks living in the green zone. It wasn't that bad. It did happen on occasion. But it wasn't as much. But it was the separation from the family and the fact that you're really reliant on the people you work with, because there's nothing else to do. You know, it's not like you could go to the beach for the weekend or up to the movie at night or something. In fact, a couple of us got together every Sunday night and we would do a movie. You know, we would get CDs from home that they would send us. And that was our social hour. And you spend a lot of time in the gym. That was the toughest part. And the advantage, though, was that, and this I found this to be very true of the agency in general, was that you had a lot of very good, very capable people who worked with a tremendous esprit de corps. And that really helped a lot in getting through that period. Plus, you had three R&Rs, so you could get home to see the family three times during your year there. And I always tell people that people that they don't realize, particularly on the outside, is how tremendous our administrative and logistical support is at the agency. I told people that when I was in Iraq, I ate more blackberries than I had in my entire life. We had just so much, such wonderful support out there, which really helps you get through that time.
I always look forward to eating at your facilities around the world. Better than most.
And we had the only bar in town. So everybody wanted an invitation to our bar as well. So
you mentioned going home. Like, what is that like? You know, is there a transition? Is there anything jarring when you're leaving like Iraq, and then next thing you know, you're back home mowing the lawn?
That didn't happen to me. I didn't have that experience because it's, you know, three times over the course of a year means you're the interim when you're actually in Iraq before you come home. It's not that great. And it's also not a time, at least in my experience, that where a lot happens in the family that you've got to catch up on and whatnot. I think we used to joke that the biggest challenge was going to be because all sorts of like candies and snacks and whatnot were free. And they were all piled up there. And in fact, the story I like to tell was I was in London, and Simon and the poll lad from at NATO came by and was asked for a briefing on UK politics. And the embassy asked me to talk to the guy. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll talk to him. So we're giving him a little briefing, answering his questions about UK political developments. And he's looking at me kind of funny throughout, you know? And then he sits back when we're done, and everybody leaves, and he comes up to me and says, I don't want to say anything when everybody else was here, but weren't you in Iraq? And I said, yeah. He says, yeah, I was with the JSOC units up in Balad that they used to come down every Friday for exchange. And he said, you know, our guys love to come down to your place because they would just go and binge on all the free food and candy and whatnot at your cafeteria. And I said, yeah, we used to laugh when the security details came to pick you guys up. Their pockets would be bulging with candy bars and packets of pretzels and peanuts and potato chips. So I think that was just another testament to how good we had it compared to others in that respect. But it was obviously great when you were going home. And when you came back, you were kind of bummed out. And I tell people that the two of the major experiences I had in terms of how I felt was the night I arrived in Baghdad. You know, I walked out of the airplane, and there was this smell of a barbecue gone bad in the air because the Iraqis are burning their garbage. And I looked around. It's about midnight. It's hot and heavy and humid already. And I just said, "Rap, what the hell were you thinking? You know, what are you going to do here? How long is this going to last?" And the other feeling was the night I went home, I went out to our airport area and to wait for the flight home. And you go to the various tents they have set up, and I turned in my weapons, my combo devices, my body armor, and I thought, oh my God, I never have to put this on again. I'm done. I'm going home. Because then you start thinking, oh, maybe Sandstorm's coming. I'm going to get stuck here, you know, all these sort of things that might hold you up. But I did have to go back several times and put all that crap back on. But the sense of relief that you had when it's over and you're going home was really tremendous. When I got home, I thought, this is great. I'm home for good now. I don't have to go back out there. You know, that was a great feeling.
So you retired in 2017. You mentioned like the special relationships, and you have this cadre of people around you, and you build these kind of strong bonds. After a long career, and I know you're consulting and you're doing other things now, but do you feel like, do you miss that? Or is that like a hole? Because it's a very unique kind of relationship, right, that you forge.
There is a hole there. And in fact, that's one of the things I enjoyed about going back, doing the part-time consulting and going into headquarters, was I kept running into people that I'd worked with over the years. And I really enjoyed seeing them. I'd grab for lunch and coffee, and they'd actually fill me in on some of the things they were doing, you know, that I really appreciated being able to catch up on that. And there was a hole there. It's fading over time. But I still enjoy, when Uncle Sam asked me to go overseas for something or whatnot, because it's almost embarrassing at times because I'll be a young officer and we'll say, oh, yeah, I used to work for you. Don't you remember? Because I had 300 people working for me in that office. So I don't remember every face, but they seem to remember it and like me. So, I mean, that's a wonderful feeling.
Well, so let's get back to your book. So tell us about Carl Baer. What's this character like?
Well, the name Carl Baer came. Baer was my father's maternal grandmother's name, and that's actually a branch of the family we're still in touch with. They come from the part of central Germany on the Fulda area. Old military historians might remember the Fulda Gap, and they keep inviting us to visit, and we haven't gotten back there. And that was actually one family branch that we were able to keep in touch with because so many of the other connections were lost at the end of World War II. But my older daughter, who is sort of the family historian, she is able to actually remake connections with the Rapp family, who are in southwest Germany in the area of Baden, just south of Karlsruhe. So I wanted to, I guess, just pull a family, a name from my family as part of that. And I decided to make him an agency, a case officer, because I was an analyst. I have to admit, it's tough to get people interested in the work of an analyst, you know, and your paperclip collection and your red pens and whatnot. So I thought, I'll make him a case officer. So as well, puts him in the field, which is what people want to read about. And it's much easier to build the sort of conflict and tension that you need in your book stories, you know, as you well know. So he's an agency officer, and he does the first book in the series, really, set in 1945, before the agency existed. He's in the agency by the end of the book, but I wanted to really have him reflect a lot of the challenges that the United States faced as we became the global leader and engaged globally more than we ever had in the past, and as well as the challenges faced by the agency as a brand new organization. You know, we were the new kid on the block. The Brits thought they had to teach us everything we were ever going to know. And as the, you know, each episode in these books presents a new challenge to the United States as the global leader is finding its roots, trying to act according to certain principles. And the agency is finding its role, which was really kind of mixed in the first few decades of our existence. You know, we were really hung up and continuing to think we were like the OSS, you know, and this was World War II. That's the world we were operating in. And that was a lot of our mission. And they realized, well, that was really wrong. That wasn't really correct. And so we had to make adjustments, and Beyer has to make adjustments in his stories as well, figuring out what is it we need to do to support U.S. national security and U.S. foreign policy? What is our role? How do we best affect that? You know, and so I think that's sort of a theme in the back that I'm hoping comes through and that the readers can pick up on.
So those are external pressures. Do you build in like wounds or flaws within the character when you're looking for like an internal character arc that meshes? And how does that mesh with this external conflict?
I think Beyer is, obviously, he makes mistakes. He finds himself in situations he shouldn't find himself in. He relies on his, this is another area where I've been able to bring in the whole sense of esprit de corps, because he has to rely on some of his colleagues. And there's one officer in particular, Ralph Del Recchio, who's often they refer to as his wingman, and he has to help him out of these difficult situations. And he finds himself in situations where he gets beat up pretty frequently. And I'll often say that's one area where I really stretch it, because if he got beat up that much, he'd be concussed. He'd be confined to a desk job in Northern Virginia. But I just found that at that particular point, that was a good way to reflect on the dangers he's facing. But he's, in many ways, he's searching himself. What should I be doing? How do I do this better? How can we all do this better? And there's others that aren't always all that cooperative. I try not to emphasize that too much because, as I say, I always found the agency to be a great place to work. I tell people I enjoyed going to work in the morning and I would do it again in a heartbeat. So I think that there is obviously not everybody's an angel there, and you can't try and pretend that they are in this book, you know, in any of these books in this character. So
when you're building these like complementary characters or antagonists in there, are you creating them from whole cloth? Are you basing them? Are you starting with something as a basis and then tweaking it? Tell us a little bit about your character creation and also your character development.
Yeah, well, most of it's been whole cloth. I mean, there's KGB officers around, so and GRU officers. What I found, the interesting thing is sometimes the adversaries, the antagonists, the bad guys are more fun to develop those characters. And it's because, I guess, because you have to make them not look like a cardboard villain, you have to really give them a background as well. That's one of the things I like, for instance, in the series, The Americans. They did a good job, I thought. At first, I didn't want to watch it because I'm going to hate this crap, but Soviet creeps. But I think what they really did was they gave you enough in those episodes to show you what motivated them, why they did what they did, you know, surviving the Second World War and whatnot, and the goal, the revolutionary goal of the Soviet Union, which was betrayed by the Soviets. But I think, so that was always a lot of fun in that part of it. And I think, but the thing I really would make is that I often didn't know how these characters were going to develop us all, because I'm a pantser. I don't plot. And as I would write these stories, I thought suddenly these guys were doing things that I never thought they would do when I started the book. You know, his major antagonist in this, I sort of got this idea from the Carla character in the Jean Le Carré books. I always thought that this major antagonist would be the villain throughout all these books. Doesn't turn out that way, you know, and I'm not going to say any more about that. So, you know, no, don't want to do a spoiler there. As well as a Stasi officer. I mean, those Stasi guys, I despise for what they did, for what they represented, and guys like Marcus Wolfe. But there's a Stasi character here, which I found it just much more fun to develop him as somebody who seems very ambiguous, very ambivalent, because he has a personal history, which I was able to explore. So I think that's one of the fun things about writing, I think, as a pantser, because I think I see it as a more organic development. And so a lot of these guys, they end up completely different than what I initially thought they would do.
If you're not a writer and you hear like a character surprising you or a character doing things, taking you in directions or saying things you don't expect, they think you're nuts, right? So, but it happens to all writers. So like, where does that come from? Like, how does that work? Because obviously all this is coming out of your imagination, right? And as you're putting yourselves inside the character, like, how does it get to a point where they're doing things you wouldn't expect? Doesn't it? That seems counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think part of it's because of the situation evolves differently than you would expect. And, I mean, that's why I like to be a pantser. But I think it's also because you just get to know people. And people are complicated and unpredictable. And that gives you, I think, leeway to play with these characters, to develop them along lines that are unusual or unexpected. And I think I've always thought that if you start developing a character a certain way and you stick to it, you force them into a certain confines, that's when they're going to start to look unreal, you know? And it's just more natural for an individual to respond to situations differently as they change. And I mean, I love to go into detail, but I don't want to say anything, particularly like the Stasi guy in the book that's I'm working on now, set during the Prague Spring. He really takes a development, but he's still working for the Stasi. He doesn't betray that, but there's other elements here that allow him and Bayer to connect at a certain level and in certain situations. And the same thing happened with the KGB officer. So I think, I just think it's because you realize that not everybody's the same. And people are different, and people change. So, thankfully.
And you have these international thrillers that are all set in different places. This is the first one in Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
And so talk a little bit about, like, setting as character and how this new setting influences your plot and your characters.
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and it's something I've always wanted to focus on. When I started writing, Private Eye detective novels, I wrote three of those. Set them in my hometown outside Chicago. And the setting was really important there because that town has changed so much over the years. And that's a reflection of the detective at the time who comes back after spending years abroad, sort of wandering around. He comes back home to connect. His home isn't there anymore. It's changed. And so that whole setting and how that affects him as a character, I thought was really important. In this case, I think the settings, one of the things I like about this series and when I discussed doing this a series with my publisher, was that when you work through the Cold War, there are a whole series of incidents, crises, events that form a great backdrop for the stories. And I think it's the things I was talking about earlier, I think you can reflect that as the setting changes. And it obviously has a great impact on the authors and how they're going to respond here. Vietnam is, you know, he goes to Vietnam with his experience being dealing with the communists in post-war Europe and the challenges that presented to Europe, to the United States. And he has a certain view of how the communists behave and how they act. He goes to Vietnam, and it's a whole different world. It's a whole different set of challenges for him. It's also a hell of a lot harder. When I showed the manuscript to a high school friend who actually served in Vietnam, I wanted him to look at it and said, Is that the right feeling to it, the right sort of sense to things? And he said, oh, yeah, especially the weather. He says, that's the one thing that everybody thought about, you know? And so I think in terms of setting, I'm always arguing for, I think, a great panel discussion, and they do them all the time, is setting his character, you know, because it is should be a whole separate character for you.
Did you go there, or did you?
No, I did not. I have to confess, I did not get to Vietnam. But it was, you know, I obviously did a lot of background reading and research in that respect, but that's the one place I didn't get to. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to show that to my high school friend to make sure, is this otherworldly? Is this too surreal, or is it real enough, you know? So I would have liked to, but never got around to it.
Oh, it's interesting that you can even do that, right? It's there's so many resources now.
Yeah.
When you're researching, so you go, okay, you have the idea, you're putting this thing in Saigon. Do you front load a lot of your research?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I was on a panel once and somebody got that question. And I think the answer somebody gave before it got to me, I thought, well, I wish I had a chance to say that, was, you know, you do a lot of front loading. I did a lot of background reading. And of course, the internet now, you know, you can Google stuff all the time, which is a great resource. It really helps. But then as you're writing, of course, you realize there's gaps. So that, well, I'm not really sure about that. What weapon is that? Would that weapon have been around then? So a lot of the detailed research you have to do is comes afterwards when you're working on when you're revising various drafts. And I know, like, for instance, my wife says, you know, I'll have guys showing up and having the Marine guards in the buildings. And she'll say, I'm not sure when the Marines started doing that, you know. And so I looked that up, and it was like, I think it was 48 when Truman started putting, or maybe it was in, it's right in the book. So I figured that much out. I refer to the regional security officer that you have in embassies. I'm not sure when those guys, that's one thing I have to look up for the new manuscript, is when we started having regional security officers. So it's, so there's a lot of that that comes afterwards to sort of fine tune the manuscript.
So when you're first drafting and you're starting, it's not just international places you haven't been, which you have to research, but it's historical. So when you're going through that and you hit something, like, how often does that happen? And does it derail, like, your flow?
No, it doesn't. Hasn't, not yet. But I think, I mean, it just, I have to pause to make sure about things. But it's interesting, you know, as a historian, I thought, well, I know all this stuff. I know what happened all then. Well, you're like, well, yeah, you're not like the professor on Gilligan's Island. You don't know everything about everything. So you got to, you do need to do some extra research. And I mean, my focus as a graduate student and as a professor was Germany and German history. So I thought, you know, I started reading Tears of Innocence, the first book in the series. I don't need to do any research. I know this stuff. Well, yeah, I did. So and fortunately there were enough books available that I could get a lot of the details straight. And then there's sort of detailed elements. I realized that I needed to do some reading on books about the whole bit about Nazi gold, you know, and all those legends that sprung out about Nazi gold being transported to the Bavarian Alps and whatnot. So I worked that into the story as well, but I didn't know anything about that before.
So do you stop writing when you hit one of those points and go research and then come back?
Yeah.
Is it hard to restart when you come back?
Not hard to restart. Actually, it's kind of a relief because, okay, now I know what to do. Now I know how it's going to go. So I think, but I do have, does cause a pause.
And how do you know when to stop researching too, right? Like, because obviously these are rabbit holes you can go down. Like, do you stop and say, okay, like, I need to know this specific thing about Nazi gold, and you look that up, find it, and then stop? Or do you just keep going deeper because you're finding really cool stuff?
I think, that can happen. Obviously, it depends on what you're researching and how much you're really interested in and how important it is to your manuscript. But I generally am able to stop and say, okay, I know now what I need to know to make this a plausible story and give it some authenticity. So the pause hasn't been that long. Well, it obviously depends on the book and the thing you need to research. It does force me to sort of stop, and I got to make sure this is going in the right direction.
So people read historical novels because they're interested in the history, right? They want to learn something too.
Yeah.
So how do you find that balance and understand when not to put in some of these really cool research that you have?
Yeah, I think, you know, that problem has also been a problem with me when I know a lot about a particular topic or I worked on something, like, for instance, the Turkish Triangle. I spent a lot of time in my career working on Turkish issues and spending time in Turkey. And I just really loaded stuff up. And I went through and I thought, readers are going to get bored with this. So I was cutting stuff out. I probably didn't cut enough out. And so that's a real challenge. And particularly if it's a historical epic or a period that you really like. You just try and get a feel for, you know, are you weighing the down? Is the plot not moving anymore? You know, do they have to sort of take a digression to figure out what's, you know, why are this being written? And that's where I try and get other readers to look at it, to come up with a notion as to, you know, is this, and then I'll ask them, how's it flowing? You know, does it really get stopped?
How do you find your beta readers for this? Is it friends and family, or are you looking for subject matter experts?
I'll look for subject matter experts, but I have to tell you, the most important reader is my wife, who did a lot of editing at the agency, and she actually likes it. And she'll go through it, and she'll also do a lot of fact checking. And that's where I get a chance to do a lot of research, because I'm waiting for her to read through it before I get back to it. And she points out to me, you know, this doesn't work, this isn't right, you know. She's always checking that stuff up on me, so I'll have to do some research on it. So other than that, I don't really have any beta readers, but my wife, I find, and then if there's folk, people I know that have an expertise or experience in a particular region or field or something, like a friend in Vietnam kind of thing. So
it's great having that expert right in the house. When you first gave her, like, can you remember your first book and the first one you gave her? What's that feeling like when you're waiting for feedback?
Well, particularly coming from my wife, I was scared, you know. So she can be pretty demanding, and she's very thorough. So it's, but now I've gotten to the point where I know she's going to make, I always knew she would make a valuable contribution, but I'm used to what she's, I know what she's looking for. And I also know that the challenges, the corrections she's going to make are necessary. And I'm not going to, you know, dispute those. Unless, I think it may have been one or two incidents in all six books where I think I might have said, I don't know about that. You know, I think I'm going to keep it the way it was. But that's pretty rare.
When you were researching Assignment in Saigon, was there one piece of information that you thought was just so cool, or something, did you discover something that really surprised you?
That's a good question. I think, you know, I did so much reading beforehand. The reading beforehand that really surprised me, was a pleasant surprise, was there's a historian, he's now at Harvard. I think at the time he published these books, he wrote two books on the lead up to the Americanization of the war. He first wrote a book, I think it was called Choosing War, which covers the periods like 62 to 64. It's Frederick, I think, Longo, something like that. He's a Swedish-American. He was at Cornell at the time. He's now at Harvard. And then he did a prequel to that about the period from the Dien Bien Phu up to, I think, the assassination of Diem. And that one, a Pulitzer. And I did all that reading like that. And what the thing that surprised me that I really enjoyed was how well the agency comes along. When he talks about, you know, researching what the agency was reporting and the analysis was providing, which was very doubtful, very cautious. Like, for instance, when the French had locked themselves into Dien Bien Phu, the thought was that, Eisenhower and the Chen Shui-bian were all saying, like, the Viet Minh, they're not going to have a chance here because, you know, the French have air superiority. They have napalm, you know. And the agency was saying, no, the French have a 50-50 chance of succeeding in this expedition there, you know. And I thought, we're actually looking pretty good there. So that was one of the things was cool. And I actually tried to work that in, and I'm hoping people don't see those references as just cheerleading, you know, for the agency, for my former employer, because it's you can document it. Yeah.
I mean, you can't really go wrong with a 50-50 prediction.
Well, this is true. And normally I would say that's avoiding a decision or avoiding an analytic conclusion. But when you see the way the thing turned out and the assumptions that most people had, it's looking pretty good in the end.
You talk about the themes in this and, you know, like the geopolitical aspect and trying to look back historically and what was happening at that time. Mm-hmm. Since you've been writing this and your characters have developed, have you looked back and found other themes that are within it, like things that are driving your characters, or like the epistemology of, like, your protagonist and in the way the lens through which they're viewing the world? Right? Have you been able to have any themes kind of come out of it, or broader themes about the conflict, or, you know, the way your characters are handling it?
Not so much, no. And I think that's the benefit of being a pantser, that a lot of that stuff evolves as the new situation arises, and then I don't think anything has made that big of a change in his perspective or his view. He's been surprised at some of the betrayals, you know, but that's, personal developments. I think that's to be expected.
Does he share your worldview? Like, how much of you is in this character?
Some would say a lot. I think not because I wasn't an operations officer. I was an analyst for most of my career. So I would say no. But somebody said, oh, well, you put, you know, a family name in there for him. So it's, you know, it's a reflection of you. It's you. I think no, but I he does share my worldview. I'm sort of a liberal Democrat. And I think he's not that pronounced because at the agency, of course, we would say you leave your politics at the door when you go there. And I'm happy to say, you know, I never voted for Ronald Reagan, but I had no problems providing the best support I could for the administration and its policies. So I think, but I would say he sort of has a liberal leaning, like I do. The challenge in assignment to Vietnam was, you know how things, assignment to Saigon, you know how things turn out. So you don't want to make him seem too, you know, omniscient and have such incredible foresight, you know, that he's a deity. So he's got to go through the same sort of doubts that everybody else had at the time. And I think that was a real challenge there, not to bring the future into the present.
How do you handle like the character arcs? Because there has to be character change as you go through this. And it's one thing to standalone mm-hmm. book, but when you're do you know how many books are in this series? Like, is there an end date, or are you just kind of
I'm kind of thinking that the Prague Spring is going to be the last one. A lot of that will depend on the reception and the publisher. I wouldn't mind going back and writing a private eye novel, because I found those a lot of fun too, particularly writing the first person narrative, which is different since this stuff's all third person narrative. I think right now it's sort of, but I left, you know, the conclusion to the Prague Spring was not all that definitive. You know, I sort of left things open. So I'll just see how I feel. I mean, at my age, I'm just taking it one book at a time and we'll see how things go. But your question about, you know, the character arc, I think it's there, but not at that profound a level, because he's carrying the same principles throughout all these stories and all his missions. And so there's always that that's motivating him. And so he's working. I mean, you don't want to make the character stale and rigid, but I think so he'll respond differently as over the years as situations arise, and his experiences teaches him new things and raises new challenges. But he's motivated by the same principles. Same, in fact, I was in the Turkish Triangle. I was going to have him have an affair with a Turkish officer of Greek descent. My wife, surprisingly, was okay with that. But the publisher said, no, you can't do this. You spent the first four books in this series, for five books in the series, developing this character as a man of integrity and principle. And suddenly he's going to do this, you know, when he's a married man, and it's going to jeopardize his mission. I said, that just doesn't make sense. You can't do this. And I thought, but it adds a lot of tension to the story, you know, that's what you're looking for. So I kept the attraction in there and the appeal. It just doesn't get, no, I shouldn't say anything. No spoilers. But it doesn't get consummated. I thought, you know, there's things that challenge him about the people that he has. And he begins to reevaluate himself and what am I, you know, am I really a man of integrity? You know, should I be doing this?
Well, that's a challenge in the series, right? You can't have major change over book to book because it's just not realistic. Yeah. So do you prefer writing standalones or series?
Well, I've been working on just this series. I first started writing the Private Eye series, which was three books. I did a standalone, which was set during the fall of the wall, which I and several people in here experienced together. So I think I like the character, and the publisher likes the series. And so I just kept working with that, you know. So, but who knows? Maybe I might go back and do a Private Eye standalone or something.
So these are really hard, and no one's putting a gun to your head to make you write books, right? Especially historical novels are incredibly hard because you're really doing double duty. What do you remember, like the first time that like story really captivated you? Think back from when you were young, or let me rephrase it. Do you think storytellers are born or are they made?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. You know, I'm one who firmly believes that everybody has a story inside them, but very few actually get that story out into a book because of all the challenges involved in putting that out. And I think, you know, it's tough. So I've read a broad range of literature. I just love reading fiction despite my background as a historian. And I can think of some books in my past that really influenced me. I don't know how much influenced what I'm writing now. Although, you know, one of my favorite books was Henry James, The American, because I thought that really captured the emergence of America and American culture. It set the new world against the old world, and it really captured that in the characters. And I thought, you know, that's part of what's going on in this book too, with Carl Byer. You know, he has confrontations with the Brits, you know, because they're very condescending in the early years. Toward he's like, you know, damn, who are these guys telling us, you know? And there'll be some exchanges with the Brits and with the French and others and the Germans. So I think there are books like that that sort of influence the view. I would say, in terms of espionage fiction, one of the most influential series books are Charles McCarthy's and his character, Paul Christopher, who I found to be sort of a model. I couldn't make Carl Barr like that because Paul Christopher, I mean, he grew up in, he's an American, he's a CIA officer, grew up in Europe, fluent in German, writes German poetry. I thought that was a little bit of a stretch for this guy and his background, you know, but he comes from a German-American family outside Chicago. His parents were social Democrats that fled the Nazis, and that's something else he carries with him. And occasionally he's challenged on that as, how American are you really? You know, and so that's something he has to deal with and respond to as well.
Did you know when you were young that you wanted to write books?
No. I mean, I always loved it, and I always thought it would be cool to do it. I never thought I would do it. I never thought I'd get around to it. And it really wasn't until I came back from Berlin during a tour there that I thought, gee, if I experienced all that happened, and I can't put that into a story, then what's the point? You know, then I'll never be a writer. And I think, so I tried, and I thought, let's see how it goes. And that's when I kind of enjoyed it. The other thing was, I when I was in graduate school, to take a break from reading history, I'd read Private Eye novels. And I remember I started reading Dorothy Sayers, and it was a Welshman that I knew at the University of Toronto. And I recommended those to him, and he read them. And then I get a letter from him after he's gone back to London, and he says, you know, I read some Raymond Chandler. He says, put your Dorothy Sayers away. He says, this is the real deal. I read Raymond Chandler and others like Dashiell Hammett and Ross McDonald, and I thought, these guys can write. This really speaks to me. And so I started out writing those Private Eye novels, almost very much of a Raymond Chandler wannabe. So that was the other challenge, is learning to develop your own voice. And people would ask me, you know, I want to be a writer. I want to be a writer. What should I do? I said, read. Read authors you like, and you'll find that that'll help you develop your own voice, because nobody's going to publish you if you don't have your own voice.
Was there anybody who influenced you or encouraged you in writing? Did you have a mentor? Or did you have somebody that let you know, besides your wife, when you were sharing this stuff with her, right, that the what you were doing and the stories you were telling were good?
I would say, yeah, I mean, yeah, eventually it was other writers that you found that, you know, oh, gee, these guys like my stuff. They think I can write. I mean, it's your peer reinforcement that was great. And I started out when I was writing, I started out writing history stuff. You know, articles, dissertation, books. I never really published a book, but some articles. But that was obviously a whole different kind of world and a different world. When I started writing fiction, it was when, you know, I started getting feedback from people. Of course, you start getting feedback from friends and families, and you figure, well, they got to like the stuff, you know. But when I started getting feedback from other writers, that's when I thought, okay, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can make a go of this.
This love of history seems like it's sort of a through line in your career.
Yeah.
What is it about studying history, being a historian, that really energizes you? What do you see in it?
You know, it's very kind of vague. It's very subjective. It's hard for me to describe. But I just always loved reading history. I was a little kid. I remember my good friend in New Jersey, Bobby Lauder, and I would get on the bus. We'd go to the library, and we would take out all those, you know, American Heritage books or I Was There books kind of things and read history. I just loved it and decided I'm going to major in history, much to my father's chagrin, but I'd never get a job. I'd never be employable. And I just, I don't know, there was just something about history that really speaks to me. And plus, it's one of the other things I enjoyed about the agency, having read all that history, done all that historical work. It was great to be in a job where I could actually apply it. And there were other people like me working there, you know, that had studied history and like talking about history books. And you see how important it is to understand the present. I mean, I don't believe history repeats itself. I think every historical epic is unique. But it's there, they definitely, the past definitely influences the present and the future. And occasionally I got to work on assignments where I was drawing directly on the history. When I think it's, I'm not crossing any bounds on classification here. When at one point, one of the European directors of the National Security Council during the Reagan administration came to our building and he says, you know, the Austrian president is coming to visit. We want to put together a background for the president that really draws on the world that the Austrian president comes from. It's a world view, his perspective on things. And it was all about the history of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Bundesliga, Vienna, the world of the literature. And put about like a 2-page briefing paper for the president. And it was all about the history that I had been studying for the last decade, you know. So that was one of the reasons I'm grateful to the agency. Plus the fact that as someone who studied history, and then I find myself in Berlin when the wall falls, Germany reunifies, one of the seminal moments in German and European history, and I'm there in the middle of it. And even if occasionally I like to claim credit for bringing the wall down, but I know some of my colleagues at the time would dispute that.
So I had a lot of fun. Thanking you, it's official.
Yeah, I had a lot of help from the Germans themselves.
So if history doesn't repeat itself, if it's not predictive, mm-hmm. what is it? Does it help you just like reveal character or the human, you know, the way humans interact? Does that bring you like a comfort by seeing it in the past because you know how it ended? Like, what is it specifically? Because you're doing it in your books.
Yeah. What I think what it does is it's the approach I always take is that every person and every issue has a history, and that will influence, that sets the context in which they operate. And it will influence their behavior. I think the Stasi officer starts out, he's an East Prussian aristocrat who's an officer in the Wehrmacht. He goes back and there's that there, but there's the structure and loss of his East Prussian homeland that influences how he's going to behave, how he approaches a lot of these issues, how committed he is to the East German state. The KGB officer, when I introduced him in the very first book, his family, he came from a wealthy merchant family. His father dealt in sable furs. He was a student activist at the university, so, you know, supported the Bolshevik Revolution. His sister and brother did not. They fled to Paris and further on to Latin America. And he spends a lot of the things motivating him is, how can I build my family again? How can I connect with my family? So there's all this history there that influences how these people act and behave. In the current context.
So it sounds like in a way you're putting together a puzzle, right? Do you see parallels with that, with the way you're looking back in history, knowing how it ended, right? Knowing whatever conflict, whatever ended, you're putting the pieces together and doing a novel where you're putting it together and then you're creating a whole at the end. Do you see any parallel with that?
Oh yeah, definitely. That's a lot of it, particularly when you're writing mysteries and thrillers, because you're creating a puzzle and you're working with a puzzle. But you don't want to have all the pieces available to the reader till the very end when they can put it together. Sometimes you can't put it all together. There's things don't end up the way you think they would have. There's still some ambiguity and ambivalence at the end, which reflects the real world. I always would tell people working as an analyst at the agency, it was like you're putting together a puzzle, but you don't have all the pieces, and you never will. So there's always going to be some uncertainty involved. And if that happens, I'm happy with that in the novels, because that's what happens in the real world, in real life. So,
well, what drove you from history into intelligence work?
I was always interested in foreign affairs as a kid. I mean, I would, you know, fourth grade, I was reading Newsweek and Time magazine and whatnot. But when I went to grad school and got my PhD, I was pretty set, I'm confident that I was going to be an academic for the rest of my life. And I taught at Iowa State, and then I signed a tenure-track contract at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. But in the back of my mind, there was always this notion that perhaps, you know, I could use this to position myself to work in foreign affairs. I took when I was in grad school, I took the foreign service exam. I passed that, came here to Washington, went through the exercises and the evaluations, then it was put on the list is in the political cone, but at the same time, I'd also reached out to the agency. And they were very interested because I lived in Austria and Germany. I was fluent, and this was the time when West Germany was the front line of the Cold War. So we had a tremendous intelligence, diplomatic, and military presence in Germany, West Germany. So they were obviously interested in that.
Right.
And, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, yeah, I'd like to be just, in fact, I told the operations people at the agency, I said, look, I'm a scholar by training. And I think, and then I'd enjoy the analyst track more than being a case officer. They still put me in the career training program with a bunch of case officers anyway, figuring I'd see the light, you know, and which turned out to be a benefit to me because I developed a lot of friendships with colleagues in the operations director, which was great. But I thought, you know, do I want to live in Arkansas as an academic earning maybe $20,000 a year for the next few decades? Or do I want to live in Washington, D.C., being right in the heart of things, the heart of the full foreign policy and national security network, and living in an area like Washington, D.C., which when I moved here in the early 80s, was great. And that's why I bit the bullet. I think the State Department had hired a few on, so that way it was closed off for the time. And when I bit the bullet, I fell in Arkansas, and I said, and I hadn't got my security clearance yet. They hadn't officially offered me a job. But I decided to take a chance. And they said, oh, you can call every week to check on how things are going. So I called Arkansas and I said, I'm sorry, I left on my phone. You know, I had already started making lectures for when I went down there. And so I just bit the bullet. And then a couple of weeks later, they offered me the job. And October 81, I drove up here with a Mustang trunk full of stuff and started my new life.
So you went from studying history to trying to actually make it.
Make history, yeah.
I mean, it's very cool. Yeah. Okay, so I got to ask you just a couple of quick questions, speed round here. So okay. about your writing craft and your process. Yours is your pantser. Do you write the same time every day?
Generally, what I'll try and do is always do at least one scene, maybe a chapter a day, because I find if I try and push it beyond that, I start to be more concerned about finishing than writing what – doing a good job with what I'm doing. So, and it's usually mid, late morning, right? Because otherwise I'm thinking about it and I can't get anything else done the rest of the day. You know, I know I want to do something today. I want to write today. So I'll get it done and then move on to other stuff.
You're one of those rare authors who wants to actually limit how much they're writing in a day as opposed to struggling to get those words down.
Yeah, I find that, it's sort of just sort of finishing so I can walk away becomes more important than actually working on the scene or the chapter.
And you work on the computer?
Yeah, I started out writing everything out longhand and then typing it. The benefit for that is as you're typing it in, that's your first revisions, you know? Mm-hmm. But then I thought, after a while, I just thought, this is just too cumbersome to write the stuff out longhand. So I now, as a friend of mine once said, I compose at the keyboard.
And do you use Word or Scrivener or do you use any software?
Yeah, Word, yeah.
And do you use any editing software? There's a lot of AI stuff out there for editing.
No, I don't. I just don't. I guess I want to be control. I want to do all that myself. So I'll just, you know, when I'm done, I'll let it sit for a while, let it germinate, or marinate, and then I'll pull it up a week or two later and just start going through it, you know, a chapter at a time.
Do you listen to music?
You know, I started doing that for a while. I would listen to Bruce Springsteen albums in the back when I was writing the Private Eye notes. I don't do that now, although I think it would behoove me to do maybe some, you know, Mozart or classical German stuff, you know, Mozart, Beethoven, not the Ninth Symphony. I don't want to, you know, get too carried away. Who knows what's going to happen in the story then. But.
And how long does this take you to write?
It takes me about a year to finish a book, to have a book that I'm confident I can send on to the publisher to see how they react to it. Yeah.
If you had one piece of writing advice for anyone out here who's thinking of writing something, what would that be?
Again, I would say read, because you not only will it help you find your voice, it'll help you find a genre that you're interested in that's going to keep pulling you back to the computer. Because I think most writers will tell you, thinking about writing and they're writing, it's like they'll think of anything they can do not to write. You know, geez, I got to do that sock drawer again. Or I think Jeffrey Deaver gave a talk at one of the C3 conferences, and he was saying how, you know, he said, okay, here's the diary of the normal day of a writer. And it's spent really trying to find something else to do. You know, I mowed the lawn yesterday, but it looks like it needs to be mowed again today. You know, I've got 3 bags of dog food in the pantry, but I think I need to get another one, you know, and stuff like that. I think so. It was, you know, you got to find something that you're going to want to sit down with. And so that helps you find your genre as well. And I think it just also helps you develop an ear for your writing so that when you read through it, you know, I was told that you should read the stuff out loud to yourself. And so you know how it flows. That gives you a better idea how it's going to flow. And you get a sense of that from reading other authors that you really like. I found that if I read like one of my favorite writers, Henry James and Joseph Conrad, if I read them while I'm writing, and now next thing I know, some of them get these cumbersome paragraphs, you know, full of exposition and prose. So you want to make sure you're reading the right stuff while you're writing.
Do other authors' voices seep into you when beyond, even if you're reading the right stuff, does that voice give you problems when you're first drafting?
No, I would say no, because that's when I try and read something else, like a history book or something. So it doesn't interfere with, the voice that I've developed and the characters I'm developing.
Okay, I'm going to ask one more question, then I'm going to go around. Okay. If anyone has questions here, I'll bring the mic around. I ask every author the same. This is the one question I ask everybody.
Okay.
Where do you think story comes from? You know, it's sitting there, you're creating these stories in your head, but some people feel like they're channeling. You know, where does it come from?
I don't know. I'd like to say there's some sort of cosmic center somewhere, you know, but I think it comes from your own experiences. You know, it's not that everything you're writing about is autobiographical, but it's the stories you've read, the places you've been, the people you've met. That's how you pull stories together, I think. And you know, because I would say when I started writing, like the first one, The Tears of Innocence, I tell people, you know, I said to my wife, you know, I want to write a story set in Berlin right after the war. I've got an opening scene I really like, but I've got no characters or plot line. And she says, well, why don't you use my father's story? He was, you know, went to Berlin right after the war as part of Operation Paperclip, and he moved into a German's house that was gone. The guy never came back from the Eastern Front, had the same name, exact same spelling. And she says, why don't you use that? You know, and I thought, okay, that's a good point of departure. And the story went from there. So I can't say that it really came out of my own head and imagination, although the book did, but the starting point came from something else in my background, because my wife's background and family, you know, and a lot of the stories start out like that. And it's just something that happens. And then you think about it and you talk about it, and then the germ of the story is, emerges from that.
The what if.
The what if. Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. I'm going to come around. Does anybody have any questions?
Bill, if Carl had a grandson or granddaughter and was now doing this craft in a future book, you would have to contend with technology. What's real for a book? And many things that come out in movies and books about the agency are rather fanciful rather than mundane stuff that normally happens.
Yeah.
But for the periods that you've been involved in, have you been able to interview very old case officers about what tradecraft was like at that time?
No, and I've had to rely on sort of memoirs or people I'd met at the time, you know, that were active in the 60s and 70s. A lot of those people aren't around anymore, you know, from the 50s and everything, even the 60s, you know, some of the 70s. But, I mean, some of the older gents, even that I knew that were there, that had been around for a while when I started, they're gone. So that's really a tough thing to do. So you have to rely on folks that were knowledgeable and writing books at the time about the agency, about spycraft work, or, you know, you just kind of go with what you know and assume it's similar. And then I might talk to other case officers that say, you know, what was it? I have an idea what it was like then. But I mean, it's the challenge. My impression has been the challenge right now isn't as great as it is now, because the change is so much more rapid, you know, and I'm not, those who know me would tell you that I'm not the most proficient IT guy. You know, I mean, I still refer to the computer as the machine at home, which my wife, it's just, Doris, go, like, the machine, you mean the computer? And so it's, it would be very difficult for me. I mean, I would have to do a lot of research and a lot of work to put it in a contemporary setting because of the challenges that presents. But I think that also might make it harder for me to get stuff through the PRB, the Publication Review Board, because these books have gone through like a week or two, because they're so dated in terms of the issues and the technology and the tradecraft, that there's just no danger of exposing current forces and methods and operational activity or people. And I think, you know, when I was, my daughter was taking getting her master's in international affairs at American University, and her prof asked me to come and talk about the agency one day. And the question I got was, what do you think is the biggest challenge facing the agency today? I said, dealing with the immense flow of data and the new technology. And I said, and that's why it's a good thing I'm retired, because I wouldn't be much help in that respect. And so that I would face that challenge in writing, you know, about Carl Byers' kids or grandchildren working in the business today.
Good question. Other questions?
Thank you. I really enjoyed the discussion tonight and you sharing your story. It's the first time that I've attended an event here, and I love it, and I'll be back. So easy question, but very practical.
Those are the ones I like.
Okay. I'm going to buy your book tonight. But should I start with this book, or do I need to start at book one? What is your advice?
You know, that's the most frequent question I get at these like writers' conferences and whatnot. I tell people that I tend to like to read books in a chronological order, and The Tears of Innocence is where a lot of the characters are initially introduced. But as I was explaining to folks just yesterday at the Soho Authors Festival, I said, you know, the publisher always insists that you put enough in so it can be a standalone story. You know, they're saying, Bill, you can't assume they've read the other books beforehand. You've got to make, you know, flesh some of this stuff out. And they're right. And each book occurs, each story occurs in a unique, separate incident or crisis in the Cold War, and that's which is the setting for it. So, and a lot of people will come to buy books, like somebody just at Suffolk, you know, one woman, the first book I sold was the third book of the series, The Budapest Escape, which takes place during this Hungarian revolt and Soviet invasion of 56. And she bought it because she signed up for a Viking cruise that's going to take her to Budapest, you know. A little later, a woman came by whose dad was in the military, had served in Turkey, and she had spent some of her youth in Turkey, so she bought The Turk's Triangle, you know. So I think a lot of people will pick a book because they're interested in a particular city or setting or event. But a lot of other people, almost, I probably sell twice as many books of copies of Tears of Innocence, the first book of the series, of all the other books together, because everybody wants to start with the first book. So a lot of people go that way as well. And I do have a copy of the first book, I think, in my trunk.
Other questions over here? How about on this side? Questions? Okay.
One of the things that my favorite espionage writers tend to disagree on is the extent to which the intelligence community is trusted and believed by whoever happens to be in power at that time. Mm-hmm. In your books, is there a flow at all? I mean, are there times where they're really trusted and times when maybe the administration doesn't or something like that?
That only comes out in Assignment in Saigon because, I mean, that was just a really big issue at the time. And it was one I think we all know about. It's easy to do research and read up on that. It doesn't really become an issue. It's more like the issue is always, we need more information. We need more analysis. Give us some more. It's not like we don't like what you're doing. I think, as my experience has been, I mean, obviously, one of the biggest challenges you face in the intelligence world is that you often are dealing with people that don't want to believe what you tell them. And they've got their own view, you know? And I would tell people, you know, the challenge to being an analyst on the United Kingdom is that anybody who's watched Downton Abbey thinks they know they got the United Kingdom, you know? Or anybody who's been on the Rhine cruise or to Oktoberfest thinks they know Germany. That was one of the benefits of working on Turkey so often, is that nobody thinks they know Turkey. You know, so there's just a steady request for streams of analysis. Often they ask the same questions year after year. So I think it was, so what Carl Byer and his colleagues are facing is more like the need, we need more information. You know, we've lost these assets. And this is a critical situation, like in the Turkish Triangle, where he investigates the death of three Soviet assets in Turkey during the Cuban Missile Crisis. People are trying to figure out, what the hell is Khrushchev up to? What's he thinking here, you know? And that's where intelligence comes in. And that's one of the driving factors in the work that they're doing.
Well, Bill, congratulations on the book. It's fantastic. I could talk to you for a really long time. You have books here for sale.
Yes, I do.
So he'll be signing up here afterwards. I'd ask you to do two things, if you would. Go on Amazon and leave him a 5-star review. It really helps. If there's 3 million plus books coming out every year, and it's hard to stand out. So that the review really, really helps. And also, if you like what we're doing here with Elaine's Literary Salon, please go on Open Table or Yelp or wherever it is you rate restaurants and give us a rating. I'd really appreciate it. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming. I'll just endorse it. I know a lot of the authors that have had events here at Elaine's, and they all speak very highly of the experience. And so I would look for you to keep a look on your calendars for when somebody's coming up here. And so I think you'll really enjoy all the events here.
Great. Thanks so much, Bill.
Okay. Thank you all.